Well, let's begin again. Hello, everyone. Okay. Let's get started again. Let's think about some indirect acting cholinomimetic drugs. If you will, this is an active site of a protein, acetylcholinesterase. You'll notice that structurally it's got two different sites that are important in binding. One's called an esterotic site, down near the ester site, and then there's an anionic site, a negatively charged site that binds to the positively charged nitrogen. So acetylcholine, which is shown here, fits in rather nicely. And so hydrolysis occurs across this oxygen, generating free choline, the free acetate group. So inhibitors are often structural analogs, or they at least have this positively charged nitrogen group that can fit in this site. And so when we think about some of the agents that are used in therapy, I've listed a few for you. The first one that's on the list is physostigmine. Now, physostigmine comes from the calabar bean. It's been used to deal with witches and witchcraft in Africa primarily. The calabar beans are ground up. They're made into a tea, and the witch is supposed to drink them. And if they live, then they've been exonerated. And if they're dead, then they were obviously a witch. So you might say, well, what's going on? And so let's review what these drugs can do. Now, I didn't give you this table, because really it's on a previous page in terms of the other table. But when you think of what excess acetylcholine can do in the body, obviously you can think about it's too much sweating, lacrimation, meiosis, blurred vision, salivation, increases in all kinds of secretions, tone and motility, cramps, vomiting, diarrhea, defecation, urinary frequency with incontinence. We've seen all these before, right? So this class of drugs does the same sort of thing again. Skeletal muscle, you can actually push them from fasciculations all the way to paralysis. So with way too much acetylcholinesterase inhibition, you got too much acetylcholine around, you can block or cause depolarizing block of the skeletal muscle. Now, if you depolarize too much skeletal muscle, what happens? Death. So you go past the tetany into just total paralysis, and as you begin to paralyze from small muscle groups, say to the fingers and toes, into the respiratory muscles, you can get into a life-threatening situation. If we think of the cardiovascular system, the bradycardia goes down, you can get a decrease in cardiac output, hypotension, and as you can see, other things are possible. Central nervous system, all kinds of changes can occur. When we think of the central nervous system, though, the drug must get into the central nervous system in order to produce the effects. So, of the drugs that we're going to talk about, this physostigmine is special. It is a tertiary amine. So that means it does get into the central nervous system, and you can get everything from anxiety, restlessness, to depressive situations, sleep disturbances, respiratory and cardiovascular depression, and so forth. So this is why, as you can see, you're paralyzing the skeletal muscles, you're messing up cardiac output, and you're producing CNS depression at high doses. If somebody put enough beans in that solution and you drank them all, and you got enough acetylcholinesterase in your body, you can see how the witches would die. So it was called a trial by ordeal in Nigeria. So that's physostigmine. The most important distinguishing feature is it's a tertiary amine and it has a lot of CNS effects. It can be used as an antidote for poisoning with mushrooms from cholinolytic agents like atropine. The next agent on the list is neostigmine. And neostigmine is an interesting beast because it has both indirect and direct actions. So what do I mean? The indirect action is, of course, the inhibition of the acetylcholinesterase. That raises the acetylcholine levels, and it's the acetylcholine that's binding to the receptor to elicit the response. But with neostigmine, you also have a direct-acting component. So neostigmine itself can bind to the neuromuscular nicotinic receptor. So it's really a mixed-acting agent. Neostigmine primarily is used in paralytic ileus, atonia of the bladder, especially in diabetics, or in patients with myasthenia gravis. Neostigmine is a quaternary amine. It has erratic oral absorption, but it has very little CNS action. So it's great in treating neuromuscular problems such as myasthenia gravis. Neostigmine has a shorter half-life. It may go out 8 hours or so, so multiple dosing becomes required. The nice thing about the next drug on the list, the pyridostigmine, is that it has a longer duration of action. Some patients can get by with once-a-day therapy. So, physostigmine, probably 6 to 8 hours. All right. Paralytic ileus is basically a non-functioning gastrointestinal tract. So you don't hear bowel sounds. It's just not moving anything through. Okay, so pyridostigmine, the most important thing to remember, and this is true with really all of these agents, is you've got to individualize the dose if you're treating a patient with myasthenia. Okay. Edrafonium, there it is. Edrafonium, short-acting, small IV dose used to diagnose myasthenia and to differentiate between myasthenic and cholinergic crises. So is everybody able to explain the difference between a myasthenic crisis and a cholinergic crisis? Okay, most heads going up and down, good sign. All right, let's see. The next group that's on the list are the carbamates. Carbamates are insecticides. You've probably heard of Carbaryl or Bagon or Aldicarb. If you go into Kmart and buy something, Bagon is a big ticket item in a lot of the roach sprays that people use in their apartments. Carbamates are common causes in poisoning cases. The good news about carbamates is that they are reversible inhibitors of the acetylcholinesterase. So they will come off in a reasonable period of time. Okay. The next group of drugs are those that are really important in terms of Alzheimer's disease. You can see the list of them there. The donepezil or Aricept is the oldest one that's been around. The idea here is that you've got now a tertiary amine. It's able to get into the central nervous system. It'll inhibit the acetylcholinesterase, and so acetylcholine levels build up, especially in the basal ganglia. The second agent there, galantamine, is an interesting thing. It was isolated from the daffodil bulb And so it used to be in kind of folklore that somebody who was having memory problems could grind up a daffodil bulb and make a tea out of it. You know, so there's an awful lot of herbal stuff that has given us really some great drugs. And so galantamine is one of those. Tacrin or Cognex has probably been around almost as long as Aricept or Donepezil. The other two are newer, but basically the function is the same. They're trying to increase acetylcholine levels in the basal ganglia primarily, but other parts of the brain as well. Yes, you can have systemic effects with it too. Okay. The last group that's on this page is the organophosphate insecticide group. Yes, sir?
What's special about these guys that give them to the CNS just as opposed to the
other? Well, several of them don't. I mean, they're not quaternary amines for one thing. That's the biggest change. We can look up the structures if you want to see something else, but yeah. Okay, the organophosphates. What's important with organophosphates? They are irreversible inhibitors. Okay. Now, how do they act as irreversible inhibitors? It turns out that if we look at this again, you don't have to turn back here, but if we were to look at this site, an organophosphate has a phosphate group out here. And many of the organophosphates have then different leaving groups off of the phosphate derivative. So phosphate's PO4. Okay, so each of these is going to have an oxygen associated with it. If the protein and the inhibitor are together too long, what happens is, instead of getting hydrolysis, you end up having one of these alkyl groups leaving the phosphate and binding to the esterotic site of the protein. So we often see in the literature a discussion of organophosphate aging or acetylcholinesterase aging. And what the aging really means is that the organophosphate is unstable enough in aqueous environments that one of those alkyl groups will leave the phosphate, bind to the protein, and effectively alkylate the protein, and now you got dead protein. So when we think about organophosphates, and somebody who may be using them, take a farmer, okay, he's just loaded his field with it. And let's say he had to mix it up, so he used his hand to measure so many cups of pesticide, and he's had enough dermal absorption, and he's coming in showing signs of acetylcholinesterase inhibition and a lot of dumbbells. What do you do? With organophosphate poisoning, because this issue of aging is so critical, you can treat them with two different things. Obviously, if you've got dumbbells, you've got way too much ACH floating around. So what can you do? You can actually give atropine to reverse the symptoms. And that's really nice because atropine is a muscarinic receptor blocker. It's short-acting. You can titrate it in your dosage regimen. And so you basically give enough atropine to get rid of the salivation and lacrimation and other difficulties. And then when they seem to be under control, you back off. And as time goes on, you just keep backing off until they don't need the atropine anymore. But with an organophosphate, you don't want this aging phenomenon to occur. So now you've got to do something to kick the organophosphate off the protein. So you give another inhibitor of acetylcholinesterase, which is called pralidoxime. Another P word, pralidoxime. What's the difference between pralidoxime and all these other agents that are used clinically? Pralidoxime is just short-acting, so it's really not the best inhibitor of the enzyme, and it leaves very, very quickly and easily. So what you're doing is setting up a competition between the organophosphate and the pralidoxime for binding to this active site of the protein. And so you can effectively reduce then the amount of organophosphate bound to protein. If you reduce the amount of organophosphate bound to protein, you reduce the amount of enzyme that could be irreversibly alkylated when the organophosphate breaks down.
So just to get that straight, so you're not actually reversing the chemical reaction, you're just simply blocking, you're using the other drug to block the action of the irreversible.
Yes. Atropine can be used to reduce the symptomology. So atropine's blocking the excess acetylcholine at the muscarinic receptor. You can use it in carbamate poisoning. You can use it in organophosphate poisoning. But with the OPs, if you had a typical one of the organophosphates happens to have, and so depending on your situation, you can have a fluoride out in here somewhere too. But you can have an isopropyl group out here. This group can then leave the organophosphate and go bind the enzyme. Okay? So if aging occurs, then this will leave the organophosphate, bind irreversibly to the enzyme. Enzyme's now dead. All the pralidoxime is doing is competing with this beast for binding to the enzyme. And as we also know, when you've got multiple substrates for the same active site, then they're going to interact anyway, because there's always some on and off, on and off, on and off diffusion situations. So that's really all the aging process is the OP is irreversibly inhibiting the protein. Yes, sir?
How long does this aging occur? Because, you know, some farmers may live a good hour from a place where they get this. Is this too late?
No. Routine, you can go pralidoxime out to about 12 hours after exposure. Some people argue that actually it's the shorter the time differential, the better, obviously, but some argue you can go out 12 hours. Yes, sir?
Every military chemical warfare bag comes with an atropine and an
IMPR. Yeah, we could talk about, what is it, VX or FX? A lot of nerve gases. So, everybody hear that? Say it louder, please.
Every military chemical warfare bag, when you get sent and deployed, it comes with a PAMPIN or pyridoxine and atropine. As soon as an attack is made, they give a signal. Everybody has to step themselves on. Sometimes two if necessary.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, it could, but no, the body can eliminate it. And some have longer half-lives than others. The good news is with these beasts, though, you're going to work to decontaminate. So if it's an oral exposure, you know, you can flush the system by giving, you know, an agent to increase GI tone and motility, cause defecation. You can give activated charcoal, which can bind up different things that would be inside the GI lumen. Once it's bound, it's less likely to be reabsorbed. The other thing that can be done, if it's a dermal exposure, you got to wash I remember a situation with a friend of mine who's an ED doc. He was saying a farmer came in, he had long fingernails, and they sent him home, and what he had done, he'd used his hand to measure the solid powder into the huge vats that he put water in, you know, on the back of the tractor. And so he had it under the fingernails. And when they told him to clean up, I mean, I guess he just didn't wash his hands that well. So he had continued exposure because of what was under the fingernails. And it wasn't until they really scrubbed him down and trimmed his nails that they removed that source of exposure. So washing properly. Another story that the guy gave me, which is kind of interesting too, is a lot of farmers wear bib overalls, right? And you don't wash your bibs on a daily basis. You might wear them 3-4 days and that sort of thing. And so once it gets into clothing, if you put that clothing back on, then the drug is, or the chemical is available then to diffuse. If it can get across the skin, it gets across the skin. And so encouraging people that have been exposed by, say, air spraying or things like that, wash their clothing. So decontamination becomes very important. Okay, what else do you need to know? Other questions? Any military stories you want to share? Okay. That has its advantages, doesn't it? Okay. Yeah, the nerve gases are a real problem, aren't they? Okay. If we continue with this section, there are a couple of other drugs that we ought to consider before we think about side effects. And the first one's metoclopramide. Metoclopramide is a weird beast. Metoclopramide, and I guess the major reason for giving it to you now is because as you begin rounding in the hospital, you'll probably see a fair number of people that have a Reglan bag hanging up, especially if you're seeing cancer patients who might have morphine bags beside it. Reglan is a dopamine receptor antagonist. It turns out that it increases GES, which is the gastroesophageal sphincter pressure. Now, if it's increasing GES pressure, what do you think it's helping prevent? Reflux. Okay. That's not all that it does. In fact, it increases esophageal and intestinal motility. So it's going to push things on out. It won't affect gastric acid secretion. So, how is Reglan used? It's used as an antiemetic. It's used to hasten the elimination of barium if somebody has a barium enema, barium contrast media. It can relieve the gastroparesis in diabetics. What is gastroparesis? It's reduced GI tone and motility. It's kind of like a partial paralysis of the gut, if you will. Reglan is also used in the treatment of opiate-induced constipation. Any patient that's on a high dose of morphine is going to be constipated. Now, with many of those patients, they're probably not taking a whole lot of food in anyway, but they may feel like they're constipated, even though there's nothing in their guts. And so the metoclopramide can help them get the feeling that GI function is normal. The final thing that I've listed here is that you can use it with Golightly or barium sulfate to evacuate the bowel for colonoscopy. Golightly, actually I shouldn't say barium sulfate, magnesium sulfate. That stuff's nasty. Golightly is a polyethylene glycol. And so it's like taking a gelatin that will never solidify, and it just, you give a whole gallon of the stuff and you have to drink it, and it's absolutely terrible.
I've heard there's like conflicting reports out there.
Yes,
The problem with the PrEP is not the polyethylene glycol polymer that they're using, but it's with leftover monomer that may be in the system. So they haven't cleaned it out as well as they should. Some docs practices use the Go Lightly. Others go with a different approach, and that is they give you the magnesium citrate, magnesium sulfate, and that acts to clean you out as well. All I can say is that I know you guys probably haven't gone through it unless you have a family history of colon cancer, and it is no fun. It's just no fun. You can imagine the rest of the story. You heard. The procedure is actually kind of cool, especially if they don't knock you out and you get to watch the camera. I didn't want to deal with that. One of the drugs that they also give you before is a really sedative antihistamine that tends to have some amnesic properties. And that stuff is terrible because they give it to you 2 days before and then the day before. And the idea is that, well, it's supposed to help kind of relax you and make this process not seem so bad. But in actuality, that day before, you are on an antihistamine hangover. You can't function. Your brain just doesn't work. I hate them. So I won't take the Vistaril. It's just terrible stuff. The procedure, did you get to watch the tape of yours? Oh, it's kind of cool. I mean, technology is kind of fun. When you see what's going on, it's interesting. But the PrEP is awful. And so where metoclopramide comes in is, if you've got a patient that's really got some problems and you're really trying to clean them out well, this metoclopramide speeds up the gut. How does metoclopramide do what it does? Well, it augments the parasympathetic nervous system and it helps work through the different plexi that are involved in GI tone and motility. So we can't really explain totally how metoclopramide works. But we do know that if you take it, things will move faster. And they'll move faster in the right direction because it'll clamp down that esophageal sphincter. Okay, so that's metoclopramide. So when you go in, you'll see it used quite a bit with various patients. Major side effects are going to be excessive bowel movement, no surprise. A little drowsiness and laziness. The last group of drugs that we'll talk about this morning are going to be the 5' phosphodiesterase inhibitors. What do we know about these guys? There are multiple forms of phosphodiesterase. So type 5 phosphodiesterase is found in higher concentrations in the penis. If you end up inhibiting that enzyme, then you end up raising cyclic GMP levels. Cyclic GMP causes dilation so that penile blood flow increases and it can help cause and sustain an erection. So in those patients that are having difficulties, then it is a very useful drug. The first one that's on the list is Viagra. It's the oldest, been around the longest. It has many drug interactions with cytochrome P450-3A4. And so if you're talking about a weekend user, it's probably no big deal, but if you're talking about a daily user, then it can be significant drug interactions if they're on a lot of other meds. We list that concurrent use with nitrates is ill-advised. Nitrates are powerful vasodilators, and they tend to work systemically. Blood pressure can be knocked way down, reflex heart rate way up. In fact, you can precipitate anginal attacks and things of that nature. So if you go and add another drug that's going to dilate, you can have the same kind of problems. Now, fortunately, these are more selective for phosphodiesterase type 5, but they do have some inhibition of other phosphodiesterases. Anything, okay, Viagra is a dilator, vasodilator, okay? So anything that's going to dilate also blood vessels is going to knock pressure down. The sympathetic system's going to kick into overdrive to try to raise it back up. Okay, so you can run the, you can run everything from hypotensive type problems to arrhythmia type problems if there's too much sympathetic drive going to the heart. The problem with a lot of the patients that take these drugs is they tend to be a little bit older. They have other medical conditions that impact. So someone who is predisposed to angina but functions fine, angina, may have an anginal attack when they take the drug. And that's just because they're that close pathologically. So it is a concern with this whole class. The major differences is going to be in length of duration. The tadalafil or Cialis is the longest lasting. It has a bioavailability of about 40%, but a duration of action of 36 hours. So it sticks around. It's called the weekend pill for obvious reasons. Now the other two agents inhibit cytochrome P453A4. It turns out that tadalafil inhibits cytochrome P450-2A9. So 3A4, 2A9, you're still inhibiting your P450s to some extent. With the last one, vardenafil, this guy is about 10 times more potent than sildenafil, and that causes some concern because anybody that abuses it and takes too much runs greater risks of having a major hypotensive episode. Okay. Now, side effects are headache, blurred vision, nasal congestion, as you can see. Just happens to be what we get. Okay. So those guys are kind of in a class all their own. But if we back up now and think about the big picture again and talk about a cholinomimetic drug, what problems can we anticipate seeing? What are potential side effects? We can bust it up at multiple levels. You can talk about side effects that occur through the muscarinic receptor. So you got your whole dumbbells situation. You can have breathing difficulties because of excessive bronchoconstriction. You can have increases in bronchial secretions, which could contribute to breathing difficulties. Diaphoresis, too much sweating, salivation, lacrimation, bradycardia, hypotension, meiosis, spasms of accommodation, so blurred distant vision, intestinal cramping, all the way to involuntary urination and involuntary defecation. So that's just a direct extension from what the drug is doing by binding muscarinic receptors. So if you think about where the receptors are and you think about what happens if you bind those receptors, then obviously the side effects should be a direct extension. If we're dealing with a drug that can get into binding nicotinic receptors, then we can have muscle fasciculations, tachycardia, and hypertension. Now, nicotinic receptors are found in a couple of places. You remember where they are? Ganglia, skeletal muscle, adrenal medulla. Why is thinking of the adrenal so important? You're now going to be dumping epi on board too. So when we think about epinephrine getting into the system, that's where your tachycardia and hypertension can kind of come in. Even though you've got a muscarinic agonist that has nicotinic receptor properties, if you end up stimulating too much epi and hitting the sympathetic side too hard, then you begin to see an increase in blood pressure, an increase in cardiac function. And then I guess the easy thing to remember about CNS effects, the compound has to be able to get into the CNS in order to have CNS effects, number one. And number two, you get the whole spectrum, from an excitatory type situation to a depression to cardiovascular collapse. So you can run the entire spectrum. But the important point to remember is they have to be at least tertiary in structure, uncharged, to be able to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the central nervous system. Now, down at the bottom, we talk about caution is indicated with cholinergic agonists. Why would caution be indicated in a patient with asthma? So if you constrict them, that's going to create problems. But what's the other problem? Increased secretions as well. Does that mean an asthmatic can't take a cholinomimetic? No, but you need to be able to watch and see if their asthma gets worse. Peptic ulcer disease. Turns out cholinergic agonists stimulate gastric acid secretion. So if they've got an ulcer, they're not going to be very happy with you. Okay, hyperthyroidism. What did we say that the thyroid hormone does? So it affects metabolism. It also affects the sensitivity of the myocardium to circulating catecholamines. So if you've got autonomic system stimulation on the muscarinic side and you've got a hyperthyroid patient, you can actually predispose them to atrial fibrillation. And again, if we go back to this table, how do you get atrial fibrillation? It's because there is the decrease in the refractory period in the atria. Okay. The final one is coronary insufficiency. How does a cholinergic agonist make coronary insufficiency worse? Okay, so you're dealing with fluid-related problems in the lung. But let's think more hydrodynamically in one tissue, the heart. So cardiac output's going down. If cardiac output goes down, what happens to coronary perfusion? It's going to drop also. So you can explain why these disease states then might be impacted more adversely by this class of drugs, just by working through the system. Okay. We will pick up next time on cholinolytics. My recommendation, again, you know, I told you on day one you needed to know that table on page 7. Well, this table helps put that table together. It should reinforce it, and all the side effects and everything else should come together now. So when you think of the cholinergic side, You now have an idea of what cholinomimetics can be used for and what some of the side effects are going to be. Right? It's all making sense? Next class is Monday. No Friday. You have pathology on Monday.